Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to another edition of the Left of Lansing podcast. You know, we are getting closer and closer to the official start of summer, but doesn't it already feel like we've reached summer with all these 80 degree days and lots of sunshine? Although we could really use some rain throughout the state. But on top of that, the cottonwoods are blowing around everywhere, causing my allergies to go completely wacko. And on top of all that, your Detroit Tigers and my Detroit Tigers are officially on a downturn. So yes, all of those signs clearly indicate that we have indeed reached summertime here in our great state of Michigan. You can follow Left of Lansing on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and I enjoy talking with you on those sites. And speaking of Twitter, I couldn't believe it, but this past Monday, WJR Radio in Detroit gave me quite a laugh because that's where I noticed a press release put out by WJR touting the next generation of talk radio with their brand new daily lineup. And that new and exciting lineup included Paul W. Smith, Tom Jordan, Kevin Dietz, Guy Gordon, Mitch Albom, and Chris Wenwick. Now, Smith, who's been the station's morning drive voice, is moving over to afternoons, and I guess that's pretty much the big change. I mean, the entire lineup is, as the Metro Detroit's Steve Neeling says, male, pale, and stale appears to be the motto of WJR. Oh, and that does not include the list of white syndicated hosts like Mark Levine, Matt Walsh, that was my Mark Levine impersonation, sorry, and Ben Shapiro. I mean, that kind of lineup, everybody, that kind of lineup just oozes diversity, doesn't it? Woo! Michigan Advance, Michigan economist and friend of the podcast, Rick Haglund, tweeted that WJR's new lineup kind of reflects Michigan's aging demographic. Oh, yes, it does. And I put out a tweet saying, this is WJR's new generation of talent. Somebody in management looked at this picture and thought this is the best way to save a dying industry. Okay, JR got rid of that right-winger Rush Limbaugh wannabe Dan Bongino, and they went local with their daily lineup. Fine. But you can't tout a new generation lineup when it's all white male boomers. Detroit News columnist Karen Dumas said, it's either one of two things. It's either who are we targeting and trying to attract and retain on this station, or we are just clueless. Trust me, Karen, they're clueless. They're sticking with an old business model from the 1990s, and they wonder why younger people just refuse to listen to radio and why car makers are removing the AM radio ban from their new cars. AM radio has turned into a place where old white men and women can remain in a constant state of fear, ignorance, and anger. This is the corporate right-wing radio business model, and it's destroyed radio. I mean, sure, big city stations are hanging on, but stations in middle and small markets keep shrinking and shrinking their staffs, and more importantly, their news staffs. I mean, that's all done by design. It is because the less media there is to cover important stories in your community, the better for corporate backers. It's that simple. Right-wing radio is supposed to scare white people and get them all riled up to vote against their economic interests. As Oliver Willis, senior writer for the American Independent, tweeted this week, he said, the sad life of a conservative is you wake up every morning, turn on Fox News, and they dutifully tell you which thing you have to spend the next 24 hours being angry about, and then you go ahead and do that. Then you wake up and repeat it. I mean, that's the story right there, everybody. That's the end goal. Tax cuts for corporations and the rich elitist Republican donor base. That's what it's all about. Thankfully, though, we have the world of podcasting to get the progressive message out to the masses. And there are many of them out there. I wanted to pay attention, though, to Michigan politics and how progressives in and outside of our state government are trying to turn around 40 years of destructive and disastrous Republican governance here in Michigan. And that's the point of Left of Lansing. Now, of course, Democrats have full control of the entire state legislature, the trifecta, and we are already seeing some big changes with Democrats in power. Good changes. But then in just when you thought you could relax. And just when you believe the right wing in Michigan has been vanquished, Beth LeBlanc from the Detroit News this week reports that former governor, the nerd himself, Rick Snyder, is coming out of hiding to help fundraise for Republicans in Michigan. The nerd who tried to recast himself as a moderate Republican is now going to fundraise for the current Republican Party in the state. But let's face it, the party has been going extreme for the past 40 years. No big surprise. House Republican leader Matt Hall said in a statement, and this is according to LeBlanc's story, Bill Parfit, oh, and by the way, Bill Parfit is heir to the Upjohn Pharmaceutical Company fortune, and Governor Snyder have created jobs to help make our economy competitive, and they know that Michigan needs a House Republican majority to provide checks and balances and refocus our government on the issues that matter to Michigan families. Now, these visionary leaders, yes, I'm going to stress that again. Matt Hall said this. Now, these visionary leaders will use their talents, okay, and experience, all right, to help us share our record of results and common sense positive vision with the people. Visionary leaders. Is that a joke, Matt? Come on. Rick Snyder portrayed himself as just a little nerdy guy who will be an old-fashioned Republican and not one of those crazy Tea Party Republicans back in 2010. You remember that. He sold himself as a moderate business leader who would run Michigan like a business. What could go wrong there? And you know what he did? He did it by eliminating local governments through handpicked emergency managers. I mean, he erased democratically elected governments and inserted his own people to run those cities. And that's how we got the Flint water crisis. I mean, this guy's plans to clean up cities, most of them with the majority of black residents, of course. I'm sure that was just a coincidence. He was going to teach them all a lesson by further cutting services and spending and finding ways to run government on the cheap. The Flint water crisis now enters stage right. Because Snyder's own people not only didn't do anything initially after all of the reports from citizens complaining about the water quality from the Flint River, but worse, they didn't do anything about it. They ignored the people. Just to remind you of the feckless and downright embarrassing so-called leadership of the nerd, here he was being questioned by Democratic Congressman Matt Cartwright of Pennsylvania during a hearing on the water crisis back in 2016. Listen.
The mayor asked you repeatedly to come to Flint during the crisis. You admit today you didn't show up for more than 7 months after he asked you.
Actually, I'm not familiar. I'd have to check my schedule.
Well, that's what he says. You didn't go to Flint until October 2015. Is that right?
I don't know if that's correct or not.
You don't know. You admit here today to seeing headline after headline about health problems, hair loss, rashes, E. coli, bacteria, sewage, Legionnaire's disease. Did you read any of those stories, Governor Snyder?
Congressman, I read a number of those stories. What I would tell you is those stories, we would follow up on them and continue to get reaffirmation from career bureaucrats that the water was safe. That was wrong.
Do you admit here today that more cases of Legionnaire's disease were reported since the switch to Flint River than, quote, all the cases in the last 5 years or more combined? Do you admit that?
Yes, and that's why I provided a table that shows
you
a number of these cases were at healthcare facilities. In terms of the numbers, there were 87 cases.
You admit here
period.
Today that even after the whole world knew that Flint residents were exposed to unimaginable levels of lead, you did not declare a state of emergency until January 2016. Isn't that true?
I took immediate action. As soon as I learned there was a lead issue, we started issuing filters to people, doing water testing, doing blood testing.
Governor
and to be
Snyder,
open with you, I wish more would have been done.
Plausible deniability only works when it's plausible.
A lot of the stuff that he did during the Flint water crisis was just downright abhorrent. But it does appear Snyder, and many in power at that time, will never be held accountable in a court of law. He gets to enjoy life, making lots of money, living comfortably, and fighting to put back an extreme Christian nationalist Republican Party in power, a same party which tried to overturn the election results here in Michigan back in 2020. But yes, I'm sorry, I'm told he is called a moderate. Meanwhile, children were drinking lead, poisoning their bodies to a degree that we still won't grasp for some time. Expectant mothers who drank the water didn't learn until later how their babies were poisoned. Oh, by the way, in the right wing in the state, sort of stay quiet on that front. Snyder's administration tried to say that he didn't know what was happening. Like, you know, he wasn't there that day. He missed that day. I don't know. Or he missed that entire year. Flint suffered thanks to both Snyder's actions and inactions, as if it hadn't suffered enough as Republican legislatures for years dried up Flint's revenue share funding by tens of millions of dollars. Look, I'm going to stress this. The Flint water crisis is an illustration of what happens when you put people who don't believe in government in said government to govern. It's how you get Rick Snyder and the Enbridge-backed Republican Party to sign off on a deal to build some sort of encased tunnel around the environmentally hazardous Line 5 pipeline, which transports oil and liquid gas under the Straits of Mackinac. What could go wrong, right? Oh, and by the way, the measure was pushed by right-wing stalwarts like former House Speaker and alleged groomer Lee Chatfield. Congratulations, Rick Snyder. You put our Great Lakes at further risk. But hey, I'm told that's the moderate position. I mean, here we are, touting our Great Lakes as a reason for people to move here, and yet we still have this old pipeline operating in our Great Lakes? I mean, please make it make sense to me. And now, here comes the nerd, using his money and influence to flip our state legislature from blue to red, all in the name of achieving the real goal in this game, tax breaks and tax incentives for their rich buddies. Flipping Michigan completely blue in 2022 has paid off in huge ways for the people, and we cannot go back. We actually have government leaders, finally in my lifetime, who believe in the concept of investing in our kids again through education. Michigan Democrats are starting to show the way by investing more into our schools, special education, mental health, and giving kids free breakfast and lunch. I mean, come on, that's a start. But if Republicans get back in the power, they will be busy pushing Betsy DeVos's debilitating and destructive school voucher plan, a plan designed to funnel public funds from public schools to private schools. And it's all designed to hurt and to disintegrate the public school system. Joining me to talk about that more here in a moment is Dr. Joshua Cowan, who is a professor of education policy at Michigan State University. You won't want to miss this, so stay tuned. Everybody, you are listening to LOL.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com.
The best way to contact me is leftoflansing@gmail.com. You can also contact me on my website, which is leftoflansing.com. And while there, you'll see thoughts that I post throughout the week, and you can get a full episode archive of the podcast there as well. That's leftoflansing.com. I'm pleased to introduce my guests here because I've wanted to turn my focus for a while on the right-wing move or war, as I like to call it, to destroy public education. He's a professor of education policy at Michigan State University and was the founding director and co-director of the Education Policy Innovation Collaborative, otherwise known as EPIC. He researches teacher quality, student and teacher mobility, and evaluations of state and local education programs. He has spent over 17 years studying school choice and voucher programs, and I'm so happy that he's here to discuss how the voucher programs really don't live up to the hype around the country. His name is Dr. Joshua Cowan. Thank you so very much for being on Left of Lansing, Doctor.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Dr. Cowan, there's so much to get to with so little time here, but I would first like to start with an op-ed that you wrote last summer in the Detroit Free Press, where you described how the current right-wing majority of the Supreme Court is starting to really tear down the wall between state and religious schools or institutions. And you also talk about what that could mean here in Michigan in the future. Could you explain exactly how the court is beginning to chip away at years and years of precedent on this issue?
It's a good week to ask that because we just got word earlier this week that in Oklahoma, a charter school company, a cyber charter school company, is attempting to create, be the first religiously run charter schools in the country. And up until now, that's been a pretty firm line. We have got lots of charter schools in Michigan. We can talk about those if you'd like. But right now, up until now anyway, that's been a line that charter schools have not crossed, is going into sort of religious territory because charter schools are public schools. We'll see what happens there. Since 2002, more than 20 years ago, the Supreme Court has at least conceptually said that school vouchers, which are taxpayer-funded tuition plans for private school, and there's lots of different ways those work. Since 2002, the Supreme Court has said those are constitutional as long as students who take the vouchers aren't compelled to attend religious ceremonies and so on. That was the original ruling in the court case 20 years ago. Since then, there have actually been a number of follow-up court cases that have come kind of clarified what the court will allow with respect to public funding for religious education. And each of those rulings has further chipped away at what used to be a pretty strong line between separation of church and state in publicly funded education. And so last summer was just the latest of those court rulings. What it comes down to is we're right on the doorstep of the U.S. Supreme Court and its far-right conservative majority saying public dollars can underwrite religious education, and not only underwrite religious education, but all of the sort of moral values and systems that go along with those. So what I've been worried about in Michigan and elsewhere isn't just the fact that, you know, you have taxpayer dollars going to these church-based schools. I think that's problematic enough. And it isn't just that when we see those from a program evaluation standpoint, the results are absolutely dreadful when it comes to academics, but also that increasingly the discriminatory value systems of some of these church-based providers are actually getting underwritten by the public dollar. And that, to me, is the fire bell and the warning sign that we all need to be paying attention to.
Absolutely. I was going to bring up that Oklahoma case that you started out with. I was reading a columnist in Salon this morning. I think her name is Amanda Marcotte. She said that to her, it just looks like that the school that was set up in Oklahoma, what is it? It's a Catholic charter virtual school. Is that, am I about right?
Yes.
All right. That it was basically not really set up to have students or anything like that. Those who wanted this school started knew exactly what they were doing, which was to get a case in the Supreme Court on this whole issue. Is that right?
Yeah. And that is a strategy that conservatives have employed across the board, right? In social policy, most recently and devastatingly on the repeal of Roe, but across the board and closer to my sort of professional line of work in the school privatization stuff. I mean, this is the tried and true manner of going about this, is setting up a policy in place and then defending it vigorously in the courts until finally, it's sort of a fait accompli or foregone conclusion that the existence of the policy proves the policy or the plan can exist. I think Amanda Marcotte's writing from a legal perspective, but I think she's absolutely right in the broader sense that that is absolutely the strategy. Dating back to Milwaukee vouchers 32 years ago, when 1990 was the first voucher program in the country to start. And the idea, it served only a few hundred kids. The idea wasn't, you know, to all of a sudden break the dam and kind of start implementing these programs everywhere in the country. It was to get a beachhead and to really kind of create a model for both the policy side and the legal side for the existence of these programs years into the future. And that's exactly what's happened.
MSU Professor of Education Policy, Dr. Joshua Cowan, is my guest here on this week's Left of Lansing. Now, in that same Free Press op-ed, you warn that while those cases in the Supreme Court don't have a real impact on Michigan schools right now, you do highlight, though, how they have opened up the door for former Trump Education Secretary and everybody's favorite Michigander, Betsy DeVos, to move forward to someday pass her, and I think it's called Let My Kids Learn voucher plan. I think that's what she calls it. Now, she and her family, of course, have given loads of cash to Republicans and right-wing institutions like Hillsdale College, for instance. But if I'm not mistaken, she clearly is advocating that her voucher plan would eventually be used to help fund religious schools in Michigan. I'm not wrong about that, right?
Oh, no, that's been the dream for years. Going back to 2000 was the first time they tried this and actually caused a split in the Republican Party in Lansing. Some folks are listening who remember that at that time during the Engler years. She actually served two terms well before serving as Trump Secretary of Ed. She served two terms as the state chairperson for the Republican Party here. And during the first of those terms, aggressively got behind, both in name and in the funding, a very similar campaign to Let My Kids Learn, the most recent failed voucher campaign. In 2000, it was on the ballot. It was called Kids First Yes at the time. These, I don't know who comes up with these names, but they all kind of have the same kind of thing. And it was, there were some minor details, but it was essentially the same plan as Let My Kids Learn 20 years later, more recently. And these plans have never succeeded anywhere in the country through direct ballot initiatives. Voters, when they've had the chance to directly weigh in on them, have soundly rejected them. Vouchers are not really that popular, especially when they're called vouchers. They gain a little more polling popularity when you call them scholarships. And there's lots of branding on these things like opportunity scholarship and hope scholarship and all this nonsense. But vouchers themselves are really unpopular. And so 20 years ago, when DeVos was party chair, she put a bunch of family money behind that plan. And it caused a split with the Engler administration, because Engler was nothing if not a smart politician and really didn't want vouchers on the ballot during the presidential race between Al Gore and George Bush at that time. And this is all publicly reported at the time. When Engler announced that he was going to oppose the initiative, DeVos angrily resigned her first stint as state party chair. And sure enough, the initiative failed. Michigan voters rejected vouchers almost by a two-thirds margin, and Al Gore carried the state. And the politics of this really haven't changed in the sense that voters still reject vouchers when they get the chance. But what has happened is that allies of the strategy, not DeVos, certainly in other states, especially this last legislative cycle, but also look at the Charles Koch organizations and other groups, have really concentrated on red state legislatures and purple state legislatures like our own to try to put candidates in place that do support these plans and then pass them through legislative mandate or fiat. What was going to happen in Michigan, and this is what I mean by anti-democratic, small d democratic, when I wrote that article for the Free Press, Governor Whitmer had already vetoed the voucher plan once.
Yep.
Almost 2 years ago now, in the fall of 21, there's a quirk in the Michigan sort of lawmaking process that allows the legislature to go ahead and enact a law without a governor's signature if it is passed on direct ballot. This is why it relates to what I'm saying about direct ballots. So what the DeVos folks were trying to do last summer when I wrote that Free Press op-ed and other outlets too, was use that process to circumvent the Democratic governor to ram this voucher bill through here. And that's very similar to what they've done in other states, in Arizona, for example. It didn't succeed for two reasons. One, if you go back, the signature gatherers kind of got swept up in that big signature gathering mess last May that knocked out top two polling gubernatorial candidates. We ended up with Tudor Dixon as the Republican nominee. And then the way that it failed was Democrats took over the legislature in Lansing. So it sort of became a moot point, and the DeVos organizations quietly withdrew the plan last December, just a few months ago. So all of which is a long-winded way of saying that these things are still out there and they're absolutely priorities for these organizations. They just have to push them through in a way that kind of circumvents direct voting, because even in red states and then in swing states like our own, they're just not very popular. And the evidence shows that they just never actually passed on a direct ballot initiative. So they have to kind of work these other angles at a local level that they're able to do.
I have to tell you that I was already conceding the fact that DeVos's voucher plan was going to get through last year. I did. I really thought they were going to do it.
I'm worried about that too, which is why I kind of on my own initiative got very vocal very quickly. I do this work in other states on the evaluation side, not on the politics side, but just saying 20 years of research on this stuff shows how terrible these programs are for kids. I was really worried that they would pass here. I will say, and I have no experience at all counting legislative votes and running any sort of political campaign, so take this as sort of an armchair quarterbacking, if you will, but having worked in this area and a lot of other states, one other group of folks that really deserve mention here that absolutely are dead opposed to vouchers are rural Republicans. I don't know that it was at all clear, even in Michigan, that there were necessarily an overwhelming number of votes to pass this bill here. I think it probably would have. I mean, when you're getting down to six or seven Republican votes and a lot of money involved, it's very hard to say no to your party, I think. But I had heard sort of in the community that there was a lot of Republican skepticism. And listen, Betsy DeVos is not popular with Michigan voters, and she's not popular with even Republican voters in Michigan. The Detroit News did a poll last fall during the governor's race, where they were polling gubernatorial and congressional candidates. And they also included DeVos favorability in that poll. And only 14% of Michiganders had favorable opinions of Betsy DeVos and only 30% of Republicans. So none of this is a foregone conclusion. But in other states, Texas being most notable in the last few weeks, it's actually been rural Republicans who have held the line and kept vouchers from passing. And it really is a state-by-state process here.
Why is that?
I mean, think about folks listening. If you know your Michigan geography, it's the same here. But in a lot of these rural communities, public schools are by far and away the largest employer. They're a major economic engine. They represent the values of the community, not always the values that, sort of I personally may have or you personally may have, but in these communities, public schools are not monolithic. I think the DeVos types and the Koch types and all these people like to talk about it as if it's this one big governmental entity, but really public schools are community-based. And so what you get are, in Texas anyway, and in Georgia was another example, you have rural Republican conservative legislatures who just say, you know, there aren't any private schools in my district in Texas, which is a massive geographic region, as you know. You know, you might have to go 150 miles to get to the next private school for some of these communities. And sort of their view was, what's in it for me? None of these folks were in a rush to push progressive policy or anything like that, but they just saw no benefit to their districts in pushing these plans. And the other piece of this is it very quickly voucher programs like this defund public education. And you can put into place certain provisions like they try to do in some of these states to buy some votes, where you might, the phrase is, hold harmless rural districts without private schools for a couple of budget cycles. But that only works for a couple of years, and then it just becomes impossible. We're seeing this in Arizona right now, where the voucher budget is through the roof. It is way past what advocate fiscal analysts sort of said to try to get the bill through. It is impossible for states to pay for two sectors of education. And what happens, most of these programs, by the way, really just fund kids who are already in private school. In state after state after state, about two-thirds to three-quarters of the users of voucher programs are already in private school in the first place. So what happens is these plans are just basically tax giveaways for existing private families. And what they do is they obligate the state to pay for, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars in new expenditures that the private sector was paying the budget cycle before. And states can't afford to do that. And so the only way that they can is to slowly defund public schools, usually by refusing to pass cost of living adjustments. In our state, I mean, I have been all over the country studying and talking about different versions of this plan. They're all very, very, very similar. These are not written at the local level. They're written by these national organizations I'm describing. It's just the price and a few mechanics that differ. In our state, which it would have been one of the worst, the original plan, Let My Kids Learn, was $350 million to start. It would have created an automatic 20% increase every year as long as 90% of the funding was spent in the previous year. And 10% of that per child was to have gone to what they call scholarship granting organizations. It's the fancy way of saying a third party vendor to administer the fund. And so we're really talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. In Arizona, the projection next year is $900 million. In the short term, it was an averted disaster here in Michigan, but it is absolutely an ongoing disaster in other states. And, you know, all it would take here is, I don't want to say even just Republican control, because it's more than that. It would take conservative activists supporting these plans. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. If Republicans took over the legislature here in Michigan in 2024, it wouldn't necessarily automatically mean that vouchers were coming. What it would mean is that there would be enormous pressure very quickly on rural Republicans, most of them up north, the upper northern peninsula, or the upper or lower peninsula and the UP, to support this bill against their interests. So we'll just have to see if that's what happens. I mean, I don't know.
You know, you said that these are designed to be tax giveaways to some families, but it's also like a tax giveaway to conservative donors too, right? I mean, who own these private schools.
Yeah, I'm less worried about that element of it, mostly because, you know, when you're a billionaire, you got those folks. I think the best way to think about the giveaway for them is that this is part of a larger anti-regulatory push, anti-government push that, you know, the DeVoses and the Kochs and all these people. It's not an accident that they've also bonded on anti-unionism, anti-worker, things like that. So I think the DeVos family's famously very religious conservative, right? And they their name has been on all kinds of other social policy that we would interpret as really, really far right at this point. But that's not true for some of their allies like the Kochs, who have been very secular. But what they're interested in, that organization is interested in, is sort of oil and gas deregulation and anti-union and anti-worker stuff. And so that's actually where they come together on these issues, is far right libertarian ideology that kind of gets what they call overregulation out of education. Put public dollars on discriminatory private schools, and we're all for it. Some of the key funders behind vouchers, their other part of their funding portfolio is anti-regulatory work in the environmental area. The most famous example of that is a group called the Bradley Foundation out of Milwaukee, just across Lake Michigan from us. Their two big spending portfolios are on school vouchers and voucher-related programs, and groups working against climate change legislation. Not coincidentally, perhaps Betsy DeVos recently, just this like month ago, received the annual Bradley Prize from that foundation. This is sort of that group's way of giving a gold star to one of their best allies around every year. And I think that's the important thing to think about here, is that for all I know, maybe they do, I don't know, but it's not so much that DeVos herself is going to profit financially. They've got billions of dollars. They don't need that. It's that these groups align on anti-regulatory, anti-government, all of these sorts of plans and policies. And from the standpoint of just, I mean, listen, this is someone who has told conservative donors that the DeVos family mission is to help execute what they call God's will on earth. And so if that's your MO and you've got $7 billion to spend, then part of that, in their view, is to fund religious schools. And I think that's where they get the payoff.
Well, Dr. Cowan, thank you very much for bringing up what you just talked about. I had a few questions about the whole curriculum that is taught at these schools, especially schools that Betsy DeVos would like to send kids to. I mean, these are schools where people would also be taught that slavery never existed, that there's no such thing as climate change, that there's no such thing as racism, that LGBTQ plus people are evil. Now, oh, and of course, that everything in progressivism is wrong, of course, and on and on and on. I mean, these schools teach a discriminating curriculum, but what's even more harmful, and I want your opinion as a professor at Michigan State University, is that once these kids get out in the real world and attend universities or wherever, or go to MSU, whatever, they aren't ready. They aren't ready for it. They are not ready for the real world.
Well, and this is why you see a lot of sort of non-Koch business groups like Chamber of Commerce-based organizations pretty opposed to these voucher plans, is that there's widespread acknowledgement that voucher plans and schemes have horrific academic results. It's been at least 10 years since we've seen anything positive out of the academics from voucher programs. To the contrary, we've seen some of the largest test score drops ever induced by public policy. I mean, you have to actually go to what the COVID-19 pandemic did to test scores, or what Hurricane Katrina did to test scores in Louisiana, to find negative impacts so strong as you do from voucher programs, which is why this nonsense about hope and opportunity and academics and leaving failing schools is all BS. And they know that. I mean, DeVos, when she was a public official, had answered for this, and she famously called the Louisiana voucher version not very well conceived, which is a politician's way of saying the results sucked. But now, as a private citizen, again, instead of pushing these programs, this anti-LGBTQ version of these programs, which has come up in the last, you know, year and a half as the culture wars have really raged, that's a fairly new aspect of this. When I started work on this, a lot of the advocacy organizations were willing to concede rules and oversight provisions that would prevent discrimination as a way of getting their foot in the door for these voucher programs. Now they're not even bothering. Now, with all these Supreme Court cases I mentioned, sort of they're just putting all of the weight on, well, it's religious. The fancy word they use in circles that I walk in is pluralism, which is another kind of, it's intellectual window dressing for discrimination. So they're not even trying anymore. In Florida, a Florida private school receiving vouchers, it received almost $2 million in vouchers last year. A Florida school made national news last year for expelling all of its gay children. And it made the...
Not to interrupt you, I'm sorry, but
no, please.
If that's what they are doing, like down in Florida and other places, I thought the whole point of a school choice plan or voucher plan for school choice, what have you, but the whole point was this will help all kids. Obviously not.
Right. I mean, that's the name of these organizations. There's the first voucher attempt here in Michigan was Kids First Yes was their name. And then this one is Let My Kids Learn. And there's a Koch-based group working with these organizations now called Yes Every Kid. I mean, they're absolutely branding these things as opportunities for all. But what they're really doing is just trying to stand up programs that are subsidizing religious schools. In Texas, which I mentioned, Governor Abbott, the sort of far-right conservative governor there, pushing these plans this cycle, he campaigned exclusively at existing private schools for his voucher plan. Now, as I mentioned, it went down in flames in the legislature because rural Republicans said, we don't have any private schools. No, we're not voting for it. But they say one thing and then they do and they act on another. You know, if you go onto the street and you say to someone, hey, should we use tax dollars to subsidize private schools? And you probably get about half of people saying yes or no, depending on who you're asking and how you phrase it. These groups are very good at asking the question in a very leading way that makes it sound like this is really beneficial and that you might need it too someday. And they've in fact attached Let My Kids Learn, the primary component of that would have been tuition for private schools, but they were trying to throw in a few sweeteners like some offsets for textbooks or for transportation and so on to try to get a few more parents and a few more voters interested in the plan. And it's a little bit of a shell game. The bottom line is kids don't benefit from vouchers academically at all. I mean, I've written about this in the past. Some of these schools teach creationism still. And if you're you're a sort of right of center conservative business organization and you're really interested in bringing new economic development to your state or investing in the workforce, or you're worried about the quality of science and math education in your community, as many of these organizations are, that's why they're opposed to vouchers, because none of what I'm describing on the academic side is that secret. We've known about these results. They've made national headlines, including in like the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. We know this. It's just a matter of how important these things are. And what I like to say is, you know, these organizations, DeVos herself included, love to point out public school shortcomings on test scores. But if you talk about test scores in the voucher world, which are much, much worse, then the answer is, well, kids are more than a test score. And pay no attention to test scores when it comes to school choice, but only when it comes to ranking and grading and trying to fail public schools.
All right. One last question. I'm not sure if you've been able to follow any of the education budget process or any of the news that's coming out of Lansing in terms of education spending, but with Democrats in control of the entire process here for the first time in decades, are you optimistic with what you're hearing so far?
Well, listen, I mean, alongside the last decade of catastrophic evidence for vouchers, one other thing has become really, really clear in the public education research community that I'm a part of. And one is that direct, sustained investment in public schools actually really pays off. There's this kind of conservative-driven idea that you're just throwing money at schools and they're not improving. In fact, study after study after study, we've got 20 straight studies now showing just how important direct investment in public schools are. One of those studies comes from Michigan just last May, which showed that, you know, in the 90s, when we passed Prop A and other state equalization plans to kind of distribute money in an equitable way, it's not just academics. That research out of the University of Michigan showed that Michigan communities had reductions in crime 5 or 10 years later when they spent more money on public schools. So short answer, yeah, we could always use more, frankly. There's never been a study yet that shows that too much funding, you know, I mean, to the extent that the state budget has, you know, there's some quibbles I might make with it, but to the extent that it has no money for privatization of schools and religious education, and it does make new investments in public schools, I think we should be optimistic about that. And the other problem about this, and I know we're out of time, but one of the worst and most devastating aspects of this whole privatization nonsense and spending money on religious schools is that it redirects the conversation away from things that we need to be talking about, like mental health, for kids. Like, I'm a big believer in, we know from the research shows that hungry kids learn less well in school. So putting investments in kids' nutrition, in lunches at school and things like that, like for every minute that we're talking about whether or not to spend money on schools that discriminate against gay kids, we are not talking about putting new investments in communities and in our community-based education systems. And I think that's, frankly, I think that's part of the plan. I don't know. That's outside my wheelhouse. But what is in my wheelhouse is that these expenditures do matter. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, listen, if conservative backers of voucher plans didn't think that money mattered, they wouldn't be out there with their hand out asking taxpayers to pick up the dime for religious schools. So they think money matters too. They just don't want it spent in public schools.
And I think that's a perfect place to stop. Dr. Joshua Cowan, MSU Professor of Education Policy. Doctor, if people would like to follow you, how can they do so?
I'm trying to be very present in media here, but I also have a Twitter account that's just Josh Cowan, MSU at twitter.com, and you can find me there.
Cool. Dr. Cowan, thank you so very much for being on, and I hope you come back soon.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
You're listening to Left of Lansing. If the podcast isn't enough and you are in need of more Pat, follow him on Twitter and like him on Facebook. Also, don't forget, you can read more of his thoughts and hear an archive of past episodes on leftoflansing.com.
I'll provide links to a few of Dr. Cowan's articles that he's written on the subject of school vouchers. Plus, I'll also provide a link to his MSU bio page in the show notes of this week's episode on leftoflansing.com. Dr. Cowan talked about how Betsy DeVos's plans to bypass not only the will of the voters, but Governor Whitmer eventually all stalled out after organizers of her failed ballot initiative withdrew all the petition signatures that they had sent to the Secretary of State. Now, there was one more point to the underhandedness of this whole plan, and that's that numerous reports surfaced of signature gatherers lying about the real purpose of the voucher proposal, saying, for example, that they were gathering signatures to help special needs kids. I mean, that's pathetic. I mean, that really is downright sick. However, though, it's not against the law, apparently, but I thought lying was considered wrong in some religious institutions. What do I know? Then again, these are the same people who voted for Donald Trump, who was married 3 times, who was found liable for sexual assault, who defrauded students from his fake university, whose foundation was exposed as a fraud, who was a habitual liar and con artist, and who also walked into the dressing rooms of his Teen USA contest. Oh yes, a true Christian man indeed. Time for the Left of Lansing last call. Former West Michigan Republican Congressman Fred Upton announced that he's supporting the so-called No Labels campaign in the 2024 presidential election. Upton said he just cannot take another Biden-Trump matchup and believes the No Labels people can present a viable alternative. He also claims that a third-party candidate will take votes away from both parties. It won't really just hurt the Democrats. Old Fred thinks that this is the best way to shake up the two-party system. No, Fred, what you are actually doing, and you know it too, you know what you're doing, you're guaranteeing that Trump or someone else from your extreme Republican Party gets into the White House. That's all. Look, I'm glad Fred couldn't stand by and watch Trump destroy our democratic institutions, but come on, that's a really low bar. Why is Fred supporting a group that will ensure Republicans stay in power? As Andrew Perez wrote in Jacobin, major donors to No Labels have included billionaires in the private equity, hedge fund, real estate, and oil and gas industries, according to a leaked donor list obtained by the Daily Beast in 2018. The group has also courted Republican mega donors. Oh yeah, No Labels has worked through these first 2.5 years to do one thing and one thing only: to gut President Biden's agenda. You want to know why Fred Upton is backing the No Labels candidate? Just follow the money. It's that simple. No Labels presents itself as a centrist party, and it would probably love to have someone like West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin run for president. Manchin is considered a centrist, but as part of that sacred bipartisan debt deal last week, Joe Manchin made out just fine as his beloved Mountain Valley gas pipeline got the green light. Sure, we here in Michigan, and of course across the country, can't see the blue sky and can't breathe due to endless smoke from those Canadian wildfires, but by all means, let's continue with more fossil fuels to further damage the planet. Woohoo! That is what is called moderation, apparently. Seriously, how is that the moderate position when the planet is facing an existential threat of climate change? It's literally burning! Here's another. We need to keep our Great Lakes clean, but I bet Fred Upton is all about keeping the Line 5 pipeline. Yes, again, though, I'm told by the rich No Labels donors how that is the so-called moderate view. Here's another. An epic MRA poll from last summer found, for example, when it comes to healthcare, 67% agree that the cost of healthcare are going up more than other things that they need. And by more than a 2-to-1 margin, voters' main concern in healthcare is that out-of-pocket costs are too high. Yet No Labels helped block. All right, let me say this again. No Labels helped block some efforts by the Biden administration to control those drug costs. But somehow, No Labels will say its opposition is the moderate position. No! When voters' main concern in healthcare is that out-of-pocket costs are too high, that's the moderate position. The extreme position is keeping drug prices higher, like No Labels wants. Guys like Fred Upton, Joe Lieberman, Joe Manchin, and all of the other No Labels people know exactly what they're doing. They want to appease corporations and their corporate donor masters. They care only about one thing, which is enriching their friends rather than helping you and me, which is why they'd be all for a Republican in office before a Democrat. You know better.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan. It's Pat Johnston.
That's it for this week's Left of Lansing. I'll be back next week to talk film incentives, as Michigan Democrats have introduced a bill that would revive incentives. However, these incentives this time around are a bit different than they were a decade ago, so tune in. Special thanks again to Dr. Joshua Cowan for being on this week and providing us with so much information behind the school voucher plan movement by the right wing in this country and in this state. Hey, Governor Whitmer signed that bill banning all handheld cell phone usage in cars. So please, as always, you can listen to any and all Left of Lansing episodes in your car, hands-free. Hey, I believe in safety. Also, don't forget to subscribe to Left of Lansing. And please, I wouldn't mind if you could give me maybe a 4 or 5 star review wherever you get your podcast. However, do that before driving, of course. Thanks again to my show voice and good friend Jessica for all of her hard work. And thank you for listening. Remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.